TV and the press. Why so many busy businessmen are snapping from the stress, and the rest of us are jogging from depression. Has it ever once occurred to you or ever crossed your mind that the problems of this nation are created by design? That no matter what they tell you, there's another bottom line, intertwined between the patterns of deception. Since our eyes were first opened and our ears began to hear, they've been herding us like cattle through our fantasies and fears. They move us through illusion and confusion of the mind, and by changing subtle meanings to the words between the lines. It's the news behind the news and the methods you can use. It's a blueprint and the plan they all rely on. And it's written in the protocols, learned elders of Zion. They'll tell you it's a forgery, they'll tell you it's a fake, that some anti-Semite voted for the money that he'd make. It's been slanderized and demonized and labeled racist hate by the same who stake a claim to its creation. Now I'm not here to try to argue if it's false or if it's true, if the author was a commie or the likes of you-know-who. What I'm really trying to tell you and to get across to you is it's a blueprint to the downfall of our nation. There's a cause to the chaos that's occurring in the land. There's a road to communism. There's a global master plan. You'll never read about it in a book of history, because it's been hidden from the masses to control their destiny. It's the news behind the news and the methods that they use. It's the blueprint and the plan they all rely on. And it's written in the protocols of the learned elders of Zion.
Don't forget, boys and girls, it was capitalism that created communism. Financed it, got it started, and the whole bit. What did that do? Well, it took a few million, several million people out of the job competitive market and manufacturing and so forth in Russia. And that was the name of the game. Knockout competition. Anyhow, that's old Carl Klang, our buddy. He's got some great songs. I'm going to be playing a lot more of them here. Haven't played some in a long time. Okay, it is the January the 3rd, 2017. It's going to take me a while to get used to that 2017 stuff. And we're still here at P.O. Box 401. Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations, and we got quite a few of them came in yesterday. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Enough to where I can go down and get some money orders to send to a few of our good buddy POWs. Yeah, that's right. We like to do that once a month to the boys, send them $25. And that's for only certain well-respected people. Don't forget our new program to where we're taking some great articles by professionals, converting them to audio and putting them up on the website, resist.com. Just go to Breaking News and you can hear them. So I probably won't be sending them out straight to you from now on. But that's where you go to get them. And otherwise, we'll be talking about other kinds of stuff. Well, we're going to talk about information coming in from our friends in Russia. We got good comrades over there in Russia. They send us information all the time. 2016 has been a fantastic year for Russia. Putin's policy of slow, low-key, and deliberate move and countermove has proved to be extremely effective. Okay. And they're going to cover several points here. Now, I want you to remember that I didn't tell you no worshiping of Putin, no worshiping of any world leader. But sometimes they do some good things and sometimes they don't. Okay, let's go down here and get some more to read here. The Hollywood Nazi-occupied Ukraine is in free fall. In fact, it's been a free fall for a while already. But just like somebody jumping from the 40th floor of a building, it's doing okay passing by the 20th floor. So did the Ukraine still have the possibility to say, so far so good, and look halfway credible to the superficial informed? Now, however, it is becoming rather obvious that the so-called revolution of dignity, which is now the neo-Nazis call the coup against Yanukovych, and that was insane for these European boys to go down there and fight against Yanukovych, is an abject failure, and the independent Ukraine is simply beyond rescue. Remember, the Ukraine used to be the dumping ground for Jews out of Russia in the old days. Yeah, so it's no wonder Ukraine's a little screwed up. The ruling class, which came to power, now is falling apart. Everybody's fighting everybody else, and there is no discernible policy left beyond the personal enrichment and survival. As for the Joan of Arc of the Ukraine and the hope of the Ukraine, Nadezhda Chavinko, she is now denounced as a traitor and an FSB agent. Forbes is now running an article entitled "Corruption is Killing Ukraine's Economy," while a former Ukrainian lawmaker has passed recordings of Poroshenko taking bribes to the FBI. As for the Ukrainian military, which Poroshenko has recently advertised as one of the five best in the world, it has only mustered enough forces to send one company-sized infantry force supported by two tank platoons to attack the Novorossians' positions near Debaltseve before getting them all killed. The situation of the Ukrainian military is so bad that they are now forced to use private cars to get to the front lines and to evacuate the wounded. As on paper, the Ukrainian military is huge, but in reality is a force which has a hard time surviving even before going into battle. Whoops. Last but not least, the entire Nazi ruling elite has thrown in full political weight behind Hillary while pouring scorn and vitriol against Trump. To say that they are now screwed would be an understatement, hence the mood of utter panic now taking over Kiev, Now, when they talk about National Socialists, these aren't real National Socialists. These are ha-ha National Socialists, the same kind I've run into here in this country that have been connected to the various intelligence agencies. And they've been working for them for a long time. The Russian policy in the Donbass, non-occupation combined with overt and covert support, was clearly the correct one. And the DNR and the LNR are getting stronger while the so-called Nazi-occupied Ukraine is going down the tubes. Vita supra, as they say. There have, however, also been clear failures, and the two main ones are the Russian inability to stop the constant shelling and attacks on civilians from the Nazis and the Russian failure to establish security inside the two republics. If first failure can be excused, there is no magic recipe to make that happen. The second one is inexcusable, as seen by the murder of several key Novorussian figures. Furthermore, the situation in the Donbass remains very difficult and potentially dangerous. In the big scheme of things, Russia did very well, but as soon as you look down to the more detailed level, many mistakes and failures became apparent. Still, it is now obvious to any decently informed person that time is now and always has been really on the side of the noble Russians, as every passing day makes them stronger and Ukraine-Nazis weaker. The Ukraine-Nazis tried everything, from blockading the peninsula to cutting off water and electricity to sending terrorist infiltrators. This gave Russia the opportunity to save Crimea from the Ukraine over and over again. It is pretty darn clear that the Ukraine-Nazis have long given up of ever getting back Crimea, and that all that is left is them are mostly ineffective ways of to try and make the people of Crimea miserable thereby. Of course, only seconds, only strengthening their resolve. Initially, there were some people in the Crimea who were not quite convinced that the nightmare was really over and that Russia truly meant business. Especially with all the rumors about Putin selling out. But now that the Russians have to put major efforts into shielding Crimea from the Ukraine-Nazi attempts at blockading it, those doubts have disappeared. Crimea's future looks extremely bright. Not only is the Russian state pouring in billions of rubles for huge infrastructural improvement and the deployment of a very large and advanced military force, but the prospects of tourism and trade are also excellent. The credit for the election of Donald Trump goes first and foremost to the American people, to whom I sincerely believe the entire planet owe a heartfelt and loud thank you. I will never be able to prove that, and thank God we will never know if I was right. But up to the last minute, I was convinced that there was a very strong probability that Hillary in the White House would have meant war, probably nuclear war with Russia. I'm still undecided about Trump, but I view his upcoming term with cautious optimism. And while I would never say never, I really very strongly feel that with Trump in the White House, the risks of war with Russia have fallen to a dramatically low level, and that barring some stunning provocation or disaster, a war with the USA and Russia has now become exceedingly unlikely. Glory be to God for his immense mercy towards us. Well, you wait for God. I'll wait for... That being said, I will dare to speculate that Russia did play a role in the election of Trump. No, not by hacking the emails or by recruiting Ron Paul as an agent of Russian propaganda, but by opening and firmly confronting the USA on all fronts and showing that Russia would not bend her knee before the Anglo-Zionist Empire. As I have written many times, Russia has been prepared for war for years, and now in a while Russians were and still are afraid of war. They're also ready and willing to fight if it's forced to do so. In his latest press conference, Putin specifically referred to the will of the Russian people as a key element in Russia's ability to defeat any aggressor when he said, quote, "We are stronger than any potential aggressor. I have no problem repeating it. I also said why we are stronger. This has to do with the effort to modernize the Russian armed forces, as well as the history and geography of our country and the current state of Russian society." And he is absolutely right. Sure, Hillary was probably stupid enough to try to impose no-fly zones over Syria, but the 200 or so generals and admirals who expressed their support for Trump probably understood what kind of folly that would entail. Furthermore, it appears that quite a few Americans are sympathetic to Russia and Putin himself. Again, in his latest press conference, Putin referred to this and made some very interesting comments. Quote, "I do not take support for the Russian president among a large part of the Republican voters as support for me personally, but rather see it as, in this case, as an indication that a substantial part of the American people share similar views with us on the world's organization, what we ought to be doing, and the common threats and challenges we are facing. It is good that there are people who sympathize with our view on traditional values because this forms a good foundation on which to build relations between two such powerful countries." It seems to me that Reagan would be happy to see his party's people winning everywhere and would welcome the victory of a newly elected president so adept at catching the public's mood and who took precisely this direction and pressed onwards to the very end, even when no one except us believed that he could win. Putin puts it down into values, common values, between the Russian and the American people. Personal sidebar, for whatever it's worth, I regularly interact with Americans who support Putin on the grounds that he stands for American values, unlike the sons of bitches in Washington. But how did the Americans become aware of what values Putin and Russia stood for, if not by the ceaseless efforts of Putin himself and the alternative media to convey these values to the general public? I think that by openly denouncing the total hypocrisy of the Anglo-Zionist Empire and by openly offering a different civilizational model, Putin and Russia did have an impact on the public opinion in the West. To put it simply, Russia has scored an ideological victory over the Anglo-Zionist imperialists. In other words, the Russian policy of standing firm against the empire while openly challenging it on ideological foundations was the correct one. It probably did have an impact upon the outcome of the election in the USA. Whoops. Russia has defeated NATO on two levels, a purely military one and a political one. On the military level, Russia has taken all the asymmetrical measures she promised to negate both the U.S. anti-missile system in Europe and the deployment of threatening military power in Eastern Europe. Russia deployed the Iskander missile, doubled of the size of her airborne forces, and initiated the creation of a tank army in the Western Strategic Direction, To read more about how Russia prepared to fight and defeat NATO, see How Russia is Preparing for World War III and the EU's Suicide by Reality Denial. On the political level, there can be little doubt that all European leaders who favored confrontation with Russia are now unpopular and is political crisis, except maybe Merkel, but Germany alone cannot do anything meaningful, or at least one positive side effect, so to speak, of the EU integration. As for the election of Trump, it has resulted in a NATO-wide panic, especially in those countries which had prostituted themselves to the empire with special enthusiasm and zeal: Poland and the three Baltic statelets, Sweden, Denmark, Holland, and our Orthodox brothers in Romania and Bulgaria. Quote, I don't see Trump dumping NATO. There would be too much opposition against that. But with Trump in the White House, all the nonsense about the Russian bear is about to invade Latvia or Poland is going to come to a crashing end, and the poor folks in Eastern Europe will come to realize that neither Russia nor the USA gives a damn about them at all. And of course, I was watching the financial news too, and it looks like with the increase in the financial situation of the United States, the market going up, the stock market going up, that means the Eastern European countries are going to be going down economically, because there are going to be problems over there. They've got more to worry about than Russia. Trump will probably put the financial squeeze on NATO and force its member states to purchase even more U.S. gear, but that will be a purely financial operation and not an attempt at surrounding Russia with military forces. Russia's ultimate goal, the replacement of NATO by a European-wide common defense agreement from Portugal to the Urals, has not happened, but the election of Trump is a huge step in the right direction. Poor EUans, my own word for the European zombies who believed that the Bilderbergers' European Union, they're now, how shall I put it politely, totally fucked. Not only did the British people defy the empire and vote for a Brexit, but now the imperial homeland has backstabbed them by electing a patriot who is not interested in maintaining the global empire, or so he says, at least for the time being. At the same time, the so-called refugee crisis is bringing several crucial EU nations to the brink of civil war. France, for example, is a basket case. While all the efforts of the elites to blame Russia for it end up in abject failures. Just check out this hilarious article in the British Sun, which accuses Russia of, I kid you not, organizing sex attacks in Germany. True, we already had the Serbian Chetniks using rape as a weapon of ethnic cleansing, and Gaddafi distributed Viagra to his soldiers to rape opposition supporters. But Putin ordered refugees to rape women in Germany is the best one, so to speak. And just in case the unthinkable happens, Germany and the Germans have already warned the Russian hackers might steal the election in Germany. If this was not so utterly disgusting, it would be hilarious. Well, I hope they do and kick that bitch Angela Merkel out. She's a Manchurian candidate if I ever saw one. Bottom line is this: the entire EU project is morally and completely bankrupt. Each EU member state is now in a deep political crisis, and the so-called elites are scrambling to find a response to what appears to be inevitable collapse of the EU order over Europe. The European militaries are a joke, all of them, and when, say, the Swedes go on Russia sub-hunting, they always end up embarrassing themselves. If there are any extraterrestrials observing us from space, the EU is beyond any doubt their laughingstock. As for the Russians, far from fearing the Europeans, they don't even take them very seriously, and they look at them with either pity or scorn for their apparently impotent lack of spine and dignity. Of course, as soon as the mentally sane leaders return to power in the various EU countries, Russia will be more than happy to trade with the EU, send and receive tourists, and generally have friendly relations. But after over three centuries of trying to sheepishly imitate the Europeans and be accepted as Europeans themselves, the Russians finally lost all interest in emulating Europe, at least in a cultural or political way. Of course, the Russians will still love German cars, French wines, Italian music, but the myth of the European cultural superiority has truly died. Good riddance. The main external factors influencing the Russian economy has been the Western sanctions, the subsequent drop in investments and credit, and especially low oil prices. Almost exactly as Putin had predicted it, it took Russia 2 years to overcome the combined effects of these factors. So says not me or a Kremlin spokesman, but the IMF. What matters here is not that this or that figure for GDP or inflation, but the fact that all key indicators for the Russian economy point to a gradual recovery and good prospects for growth. I personally think the policies of the economic bloc of the Medvedev government made the effects of the crisis even worse than they had been. But I have to admit that despite the major mistakes committed by the Russian government, the Russian economy is recovering. Also, let me interject something here. I think what you're going to see is not so much yelling and screaming about the North Atlantic Treaty or NATO organization, and also between Russia and the United States. I think you're going to see both Russia and the United States start stepping on Saudi Arabia, which has needed stepped on for a long time. It's the most inhuman regime in the Middle East. It's a long time coming, but I hope that's true, that that's going to happen. If I had to score the performance of the Russian government policy, I would have given it a maximum of 2.25. Since I am looking at the state of the economy, I have to give it an objective 3.5. I just think that 5.5 would have been possible. One small point here, some have made a great deal of noise around the planned reduction of Russian defense spending, but what they are missing is that the reduction has been made possible by the spending over the past couple of years and the Russian defense program by 2020. Has not been in any way amended, never mind reduced. In other words, the Russian military can afford to use less money for a couple of years, and there will be no cuts in defense programs as planned by 2020. Russian public opinion 4/5, in spite of the still strong grip of the IMF types in the Russian government, have over the key economic decisions in Russia. There are some signs that things are getting better and that the Russian public is getting some of the heads it wanted to see rolling. Here I am, of course, referring to the arrest of Minister of Economic Development of the Russian Federation, Alexei Yurikeyev. Of course, the list of candidates for termination and arrest is much longer, but Yurikeyev was definitely one of the most influential and toxic members of the Atlantic integrationists. And the hysterical reaction of the Russian liberal press clearly shows how painful this arrest is to the Russian fifth column. As for right now, the arrest of Yurikeyev has not been followed by more sackings and arrests, but it is quite possible that Putin did with Yurikeyev what he already once did with Berezovskiy. Hit at the one big guy and therefore forced the rest of his gang to play ball and give up any hopes of confronting him. Only time will tell if sacking and arresting Yurikeyev will be enough to finally re-sovereignize Russia, but it sure is a very good beginning. Russiaphobes 4/5 sounds weird, doesn't it? Russiaphobes. reminds me of the self-hating Jew category. And yet, they exist, at least nominally. I say nominally because being Russian has never been about speaking Russian or about living in Russia or even about some hypothetical Russian ethnicity, which really does not exist. One definition is what is to be Russian was given by the philosopher Vasily Razanov. Okay, see what he just said. Quote, I love a happy and great motherland is really not a big thing. We have to love her when she is weak, small, humiliated, finally stupid, finally even filled with vices. It is when our mother is drunk, lying, and all entangled in her sins that we must not depart from her. But even that is not enough. When she finally dies, eaten up by the Jews, and when only her bones remain, we will be truly Russian, who will weep over her useless skeleton, abandoned by all. He truly shall be. Following prophetic words in 1913. Needless to say, Razanov is hated by the Russian liberals. Contrary to Razanov, these Russophobic liberals rejoice in every Russian failure, and they can barely contain their joy when some tragedy befalls the Russian people, which they hate and despise for supporting a tyrant like Putin instead of them, the self-perceived intellectual elites of Russia. Sounds exactly like the United States to me. When Putin came to power, these fifth Russophobic columnists were literally everywhere, since their families were usually members of the Soviet elites, and since during the infamous 1990s they literally took control of every single lever of power in Russia, from the mass media to the Kremlin. First, Putin got rid of the oligarchs, especially the seven bankers. Next, he gradually pushed most of them out from the mass media. That is when their colleagues and patrons in the West began speaking of the lack of free press in Russia. And then he began the slow and outright dangerous process of getting rid of them, one by one, from inside the Russian government, including the Kremlin. But Putin's biggest achievement this year has been his extremely successful campaign to delegitimize this fifth column. He did that by cracking down on them, nor did he murder any journalist or opposition figure, and he did not fill the new Russian gulag with thousands of liberal dissenters. I mean not only Putin himself but also his supporters did the exact opposite. He gave them a platform, and he made darn sure that their views would be freely aired on almost a daily basis. Those interested about this can read my analysis, Counterpropaganda Russian Style. This was pure genius. Instead of silencing the Russophobes, Putin gave them a completely disproportionate amount of airtime. Keep in mind that less than 5% of the Russian population supports these freaks, and let them hang themselves by being wrong on just about everything. They were wrong on the Crimea, they were wrong on the Ukraine, wrong on the economy, wrong on the social and civil rights, wrong on corruption, wrong on so-called gay rights, wrong about NATO, wrong about the EU, wrong about Clinton. They loved her. Wrong about Trump, they hated him. Wrong about terrorism and wrong about Syria. As a result, these liberals in the Russian meaning of the word are now universally seen as traitors, Russophobes, snobs, racists, and fifth columnists. They are now absolutely hated and desperate. As a result, during the recent elections, we saw the amazing sight of Russian liberals, including Jews, aligning themselves with the Nazis and organizing joint protests against Putin. Needless to say, they only served to further discredit them. There are still plenty of fifth columnists in Russia, but they are mostly laying really low, hoping for better times and trying to remain out of the public eye as much as possible. Their main remaining center of power is the Russian Central Bank, and as the economic bloc for the Medvedev government. But since both Kutrin and Yulakovin have been kicked out, the rest of them are being very careful in their actions and statements. All in all, 2016 has been an absolutely catastrophic year for the Russophobic fifth column, which is now in a state of total despair and which seems to have no future whatever. Russia's success in Syria is nothing short of amazing. Not only did an extremely small Russian military force succeed in turning around the course of the war, but it has held an essentially indefensible position long enough to deter Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states and the USA from overtly attacking the Syrian forces or the government. The Russians succeeded in this despite numerous ugly and bloody provocations and despite having to operate in an extremely hostile environment. The region belongs to NATO and CENTCOM. One of the most amazing successes was how the Russians managed to save Erdogan in extremis from a U.S.-backed coup and convince him to work with Russia, Iran, to solve the Syrian crisis. The liberation of Aleppo could not have happened had Turkey continued to support al-Nusra and company at any price. At the very least, it would have taken much more time. By the end of 2016, the Russians owned the Black Sea, control, at least from the time being, the Eastern Mediterranean, and they are working with the three biggest powers on the ground. The Syrians, of course, but also Iran and Turkey. As for the United States, they seem to have lost the entire region, and their only achievement, so to speak, has been to alienate both Israel and the Saudis. As for President-elect Trump, he has clearly indicated that his number one priority will be to smash Daesh and company, which happens to be exactly what Russia, Iran, and Syria want. If Trump really manages to, if Trump really manages to kick the neocons crazies to the cockroach-filled basement where they belong, we could see something quite amazing happen, a joint Russian-U.S. effort to destroy Daesh, or ISIS. The big problem here will be the totally counterproductive and, frankly, idiotic anti-Iranian rhetoric of the Trump campaign. However, there must be enough good brains around Trump to make him understand there's nothing in the region that can happen without Iran's approval, and that the U.S. and Iran don't need to love each other to agree on a common objective. Trump strikes me as a realist much more than as an ideologue. Hopefully he will learn how to separate AIPAC pleasing rhetoric from serious foreign policy. The crash of the Obama administration ought to teach him that lesson. What is certain is that Russia is now running the show in Syria, and that without U.S. and or Turkish support, ISIS will be faced an existential crisis. Of course, the situation remains fluid, complex, and dangerous. And I would never put it past the U.S. or Turkey to do yet another 180 degree and resume their support of ISIS. The Kurdish factor, Israeli policies, and Erdogan of Turkey inherent unpredictability all serve to make sure that the Syrian crisis will continue well into 2017. However, I think that the neocons' crazy rampage has reached its apogee, and that things should begin to improve from now on. Russia alone simply could not save Syria, and yet she appears to have done just that. The Russophobic hysteria in the West. There was simply no way that the Anglo-Zionists could be defeated on all fronts without screaming "Oy vey" to the high heaven, and screaming they did all year long. Their allegations range from Russia wanting to invade Latvia to Russian hackers stealing the U.S. election. And to make absolutely sure that there was no doubt at all that as to the identity of these hackers, the Anglo-Zionists informed us that these hackers called themselves Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear, that they used aliases Felix Edmondovich, the first name of the patriarch Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Soviet Secret Services, and that they worked during Moscow time offices hours, and they took breaks during the Russian holidays. And at least you think that this is kind of nonsense was made up in a mental institution or a kindergarten. Here is the link to the article in the New York Times quoting security experts. Amazing, no? But then again, when I see the neocons seriously calling Ron Paul a Russian agent, I realize that there is nothing, no matter how stupid, that these guys would not dare say. Chutzpah in action, I suppose. And while the left side of the bell curve appears to have fully internalized the message, there is a growing segment of the population which realizes how silly all these accusations are. Personal sidebar, while I am sure that there are some Americans who believe that the Ruskies are a dangerous enemy of the USA, I have yet to meet even one such American. In my day-to-day interactions, I see no hostility between the Russians, even when I openly speak Russian with my family, in stores or restaurants, and when I say that I am Russian. Maybe this is because I am in Florida and not in New York. But I have yet to see a single example of anti-Russian hostility. The Russian treatment of the Western-controlled WADA at the Rio Olympics was an absolute outrage, a farce, and a crime all wrapped up into one. And Russia is very much to blame for having allowed the key world organization to become so controlled by the West. However, let's also see that the USA failed to have Russia completely banned from Rio, and that the Russian hackers, yes, they do exist, have uncovered convincing evidence which discredits WADA and the entire system behind it. I would call that growing pains for the post-Soviet Russian sport. Russia now needs to clean house in a very real cases of doping, while at the same time wresting the control of key international organizations from the West. Boys and girls, we've got quite a bit more here, but I'm going to knock it off here because I can put this onto the website. I can convert it to audio or an MP3 and put it up on breaking news. But these are a handful of so-called patriots. I don't like the term patriot, but a lot of people use it. Of Americans and Russians that talk together and analyze things. And I've been off and on talking to those people for several years. And we get a lot talked about, you know. They're all a bunch of lone wolves. So anyhow, that's probably about as straight of information as you could get coming out of this internet. Well, I see that the Trump Pentagon pick, General James Mattis, Madman Mattis, is accused Israel of heading to apartheid. Well, they do have a form of apartheid now, so why not just go all out if you want to have separation, racial and religious separation from the Palestinians and Arabs? Just go ahead and do it, you know. Quit playing games and pretending you're something you're not. Well, the choir's performance at Trump's inauguration divides the Mormons. Soprano Jan Chamberlain resigned from the group in protest, writing that the performance would look like an endorsement of Trump. What about all the years that people who didn't like Obama and all those kind of people were almost forced into singing and doing all kinds of stuff for these idiots? You see, they're not used to it, these neoliberals, these neocons. They can't take it when they lose. They're going to be like a child stomping their feet. Here's an interesting one. India's High Court says political candidates can't appeal on the basis of religion. A majority of justices ruled that the elections won on religious or caste-based appeals could be declared null and void. That could be a good thing. I see that Dylan Roof is going to plead his own case at his trial, probably, I think they said, tomorrow, so that's going to be interesting. Angela Merkel of Germany is truly insane, or an agent of some kind. Merkel says Islamic terrorism is the biggest test for Germany. Well, if you didn't bring them in there, it wouldn't be a test. Duh. Oh boy, New York Police Department is going to allow officers to wear turbans, beards, for religious reasons as the country gradually goes Islamic. Whoa, man. I wonder if they would allow a skinhead to put a swastika on top of his head and that'd be okay? Well, they're saying the Israeli experts say Israeli is coming apart. Because of too much religion and too many types of religion. And they got too small a country to have all these fanatic religions. They're all there, Ben. And probably that's going to end up in the destruction of Israel. Because there's less and less secular places in Israel for secular people to get together. Every square inch is being taken up by some kind of religion. Well, guess what? A Baptist lawmaker seeks to remove the state from marriage debate. A Missouri state representative has filed a bill so that the state would issue no marriage license, but only contracts of domestic union. Oh, they'll do anything to get out of a big argument. Was 2016 the worst year for ultra-Orthodox suicide and overdoses? Amid a nationwide epidemic and a surge in suicide rates, some insiders say young people on the fringes of Orthodox life are being hit particularly hard, committing suicide. Well, this Orthodox Jew, his name was Bori Deutsch, can't keep track of the number of people he knew who died of suicide or overdose this year. Four were close friends, one of them hung himself, one drove the wrong way on a highway, and two overdosed. Others he knew in passing. I knew many of them, unfortunately, he said. In the matter-of-fact manner of someone growing used to tragedy, it's not easy at all. Activists are warning of a crisis on the edges of the ultra-Orthodox community. Amid a nationwide epidemic and a surge in suicide rates, some insiders say that young people on the fringes of Orthodox life are being hit particularly hard. Because a lot of these Orthodox Jews are on the fringes of Orthodoxy. They're being hit pretty hard. They aren't fully enmeshed in the religious community, nor have they left it altogether to build lives in the secular world. Deutsch is an anti-abuse activist, said that it was the worst year for these sorts of deaths in his community in recent memory. The evidence for the phenomenon is anecdotal, experts say, but Ziv Gluck, who runs the Orthodox social service group Amudin, has claimed that 65 members of the Orthodox community in New York area died of overdose in the past Jewish calendar year, and dozens more have died of unnatural causes. Wow. Where's Eichmann? He'd be all excited. What's going to happen next? They just opened a McDonald's hamburger stand near the Vatican. Isn't anything sacred anymore? McDonald's is probably more honest than the Vatican. They like the Nazis in Taiwan. This was just the latest flap. A group of students from a private high school in Taiwan held a mock rally, Nazi rally, just before the Christmas, with a cardboard tank, look-alike uniforms, and swastikas. The bizarre display of Nazi costumery and antecedents in 2000 is a Taipei restaurateur opened a concentration camp-themed diner. The following year, a major political party changed a campaign ad that mentioned Hitler. Oh, wow. Every couple of years, Taiwan catches the West off guard with a display of Nazism used for play, humor, and commerce. Jewish rights groups and Israeli governments usually condemn the acts, prompting the perpetrators to stand down. But they're probably getting tired of standing down. At the Hsinko Kung Fu Senior High School in northern Taiwan, the principal offered to quit as German and Israeli officials in Taipei, as well as Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen, condemned the mock rally. Tsai herself apologized for the event as offensive to Jewish people. Well, who gives a shit? How many Jewish people are in Taiwan? Probably too many. But these awkward exchanges usually stem from ignorance rather than anti-Semitism or neo-Nazi ideals, the academic experts and others say. Well, I don't think so. I think these kids know that they're sticking a needle in the eye of the Jews. They like to get the reaction. Young people may simply like the look of World War II era German uniforms or see the Nazis as a symbol of strength. I'm not attributing anti-Semitism or neo-Nazism to anyone in Taiwan, said Asher Yarden, representative with the Israeli Economic and Cultural Office in Taipei, a de facto embassy that often is the first to complain about such displays. It is ignorance. Taiwan's unique exposure to World War II, its modern-day diplomatic isolation, and people's lack of awareness about what the real Nazis did in Europe, including the Holocaust, underpinned the trend. I don't think it's anything special. I just think it's a show-off attempt, said Linda Arrigo, an American-born academic researcher based in the suburban Taipei, speaking of the mock Nazi rally. Let's see here. I think it shows Taiwan's lack of awareness about other countries and other parts of the world. All bullshit. Those Taiwanese, they know all about these other parts of the world. Taiwan was a Japanese colony from 1895 to the end of World War II and fought along Japan and German allies in the Asian theater. Some older Taiwanese credit the Japanese for building much of today's public infrastructure. Younger Taiwanese like Japanese food, carton, and literature, while Japan is the Taiwanese people's top travel destination. Yeah. Taiwanese who learn World War II history might not associate it with the problematic use of the Nazi symbols because formal education does not teach that kind of linkage, said Jens Dahm, associate professor at the Graduate Institute of Taiwan Studies at the Changzheng Christian University. Displays of Nazi symbols for commerce or entertainment also occur in mainland China, South Korea, and Thailand. Reports of Nazi imitations in Taiwan go back to at least 1999. That year, the local promoter of a German space heater brand used a smiling Hitler image on the subway billboards, drawing protest statements from the German and Israeli officials in Taipei. "Methinks you protest too much." "I do think the Jews protest too much, and they cause a lot of the anti-Jewish backlash." 4 years later, and an Israeli government representative learned that the popular piece of Taiwanese army music was modeled after the Nazi march song Panzerlied, which was composed in 1933. 2 years ago, a Taiwanese restaurant struck the name Long Live the Nazis from the names of two of its German sausage-filled dishes after receiving complaints. The school behind the mock Nazi rally declined comment except to say the principal had offered to resign. Photos of the rally had landed on social media, giving the event wider exposure and setting off a backlash. Taiwan's education minister says that high schools teach World War II history with specific knowledge depending on which publisher's textbooks a school picks. Well, evidently, they got some pro-German World War II textbooks. Well, Japan, I mean, you know, they were allies of the Germans. And I saw the pictures while I was over there, a lot of photographs with the people lining the streets with swastika flags. Books and teachers always show the photos, and if there's time, I'll try to show Schindler's List, Lang said, referring to the 1993 Steven Spielberg film about the Holocaust. Classmates will feel sympathy towards the Jewish people. Electronic toys and games played outside school, plus the availability of knockoff German army clothes, may stoke curiosity about the Nazis, Ling said. But Pan Chi Chi, a university student at the southern Taiwan city of Tainan, said the high school rally shows the need for more education. "How could they not know what the reaction would be?" Pan said. "We should improve the teaching of history. We know about the Holocaust, but we don't have a deep understanding of it." How deep do you need to understand? The concentration camp, and they dump people in some places in the furnace. Taiwan's diplomatic isolation may stop people from making a mental link between the textbook knowledge of World War II and the use of Nazi symbols, said Raymond Wu, managing director of the Taipei-based political risk consultancy and intelligence. China sees self-ruled Taiwan as part of the territory and curbs the Taipei government's foreign diplomacy. Okay. Anyhow, those damn Taiwanese Nazis are raising hell over there in Asia. It's got to stop. Uh-oh, just what I thought. About 1,000 Jewish people live in Taiwan, population 23 million, said Ross Feingold, chairman of the Taipei Jewish Center. "The center tries to raise awareness," he said. "It's pretty clear that in places where you have an influential Jewish presence, or in places where there's a direct connection to World War II, such as Europe, either you don't see a phenomenon like this, or they're motivated by something different. But Taiwanese are starting to understand the impacts of displaying Nazi symbols," Yarden says, pointing to the presidential apology and the school principal's resignation offer. In January 2016, Taiwan also established an annual Holocaust Memorial Day, which brought out then-President Ma Ying-jeou and 200 others to celebrate. I wonder if they're celebrating that it happened, or celebrate, it's bad that it did happen. You don't know for sure, the inscrutable Asian, you know. I personally think that the Taiwanese are celebrating the fact that the Holocaust supposedly happened.